Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
With guest co-host.
Ohm Wrecker. So where was the Civ 2 community at the time? Because from what I recall, everyone was still in like the BBS era at that time.
Oh man, Civ community history. I love to talk, as if you couldn't tell from
the show. Really?
Hello, boys and girls, and those of an older persuasion. I'm the Mean Team. Welcome to episode 149. Today I am joined by regular co-hosts, Daniel Quick.
Hello, everyone.
QNL. Makalua.
That's what she has to say to your comment about it and older people. Calling us all senior citizens now?
Boys and girls and those of an older persuasion. I'm just being all-inclusive. Makalua?
Mm-hmm. You already said me.
Okay, well, I wasn't sure if that was what you wanted to count as your thing, talking about age, but okay. And finally, guest co-host, the Ohm Wrecker.
Hey, what's going on?
Yeah, he brings up age and they ask me why I'm talking about it.
And just to let you know, I totally did that on purpose, putting myself on mute, that is. You know.
Yeah.
Totally. Like story.
She totally puts herself on mute on purpose all the time. It's her attack against us. We're defenseless.
Some guy has been playing the same game of Civilization 2 for the past 10 years. He's like, what? What is this? He stops and he plays other things, but he just keeps coming at this one particular game. Now, I don't know how he's hacked it so that it's 3991 AD in the game, but at this point, there's only like three huge empires left. Himself is the Celts, the Vikings, and the Americans, and most of the world is just a hellhole of nuclear devastation. So basically, he's turned Civ 2 into Fallout. There's all sorts of things, like there's no more big cities. He says that the world population had its peak 2,000 years ago, and roughly 90% of the world's population has died from starvation because there's no farmland left, because between the nuclear stuff and his polar caps melting multiple times, you know, there's just a bunch of swampland. He goes, you've heard of the 100-year war? Try the 1,700-year war. Because there's three remaining nations. They'll have a ceasefire for like 10 minutes, and then somebody will launch a sneak attack. And I quote sneak attack in there because at this point he's probably expecting it. But everybody's got the Strategic Defense Initiative, so they don't nuke the cities. They nuke the armies.
You know, this is why I always advocate when you get access to the nukes, you make sure that nobody else gets access to nukes through your employment of nukes. Then this whole problem can be averted.
Yeah, he's pretty much figured out at this point that they sort of have a military stalemate. I mean, he would like to conquer the other nations so he could actually get on with, you know, cleaning up some of this crap and grow his cities again. But just about the time he would get something cleared, a new war starts, somebody starts nuking everything again. The other two, it's interesting, he's a communist state and the other two are theocracies. He wanted to stay a democracy, but the Senate would always overrule him when he wanted to declare war before the Vikings did. And then, of course, the Vikings would then break the ceasefire like clockwork the very next turn.
It's been so long since I've played Civ 2. What were the rules on nukes being nuked? Did nukes destroy nukes?
I don't believe so.
No?
It's been a while for me, too. And I'm wondering, is he trying to drag it on a little bit? Because you would think that...
Probably.
Like, looking at the screenshots, you would think he'd have some way to maybe flank the AI or something to get some of the cities and take them out.
Or at the very least go through and burn the other cities when he takes them over in a war. Of course, as we know, the AI and all the other Civ games, as soon as the ceasefire is declared, they resettle it.
There will be no ceasefire.
3991, that's like turn 2000 or something like that.
He's been transferring the save file. He says this in the comments. He's been transferring the save file from computer to computer over the years. So, I don't know. Is that how he did it? Anyway, like, because this was his response to a question asking what level he played at, and it was either Prince or King. As I recall, he says, anything beyond that was virtually unplayable in Civ 2.
If those difficulty levels existed, somebody had to have been able to progress in them when they did QA.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if it was just abuse of the game, which is how you usually win on high difficulty levels, because that's what they're designed around.
Even now, winning a high difficulty level, abuse game.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, so this user, Lycerus, he says in his closing on Reddit that his goal for the next few years... And I'm thinking, is that in-game or is that in real life?
I think he's in real life. Because later on in one of the Reddit comments, he's talking about how he'd love to build up a core of engineers, but it would take him months in real time to get that done. I don't know, maybe the turn time takes forever. He's committed to only one turn a day if he plays.
He wants the engineers to clear swamps and follow so the farming can resume so he can get the population back up. He wants to rebuild the world.
You got to get to your enemies out of the way first, or they're never going to be able to rebuild it.
I know, just in time for the Vikings to nuke it all again.
It's interesting you say that. Yeah. I don't know if anybody saw the related post, but in less than 24 hours, another user on Reddit had resolved his problem. It took 58 years in game, but I pulled it off.
58 years in game. Well, hey.
This does not surprise me.
This is from Self, the Internal War, is the person's username. It talks about, be smart about what you're buying. Offshore platforms are mandatory on any major coast city for any production to occur. I only built two engineers the entire game. You do not need them. Doing the massive re-terraforming of Earth is a lengthy and difficult process, even if nukes weren't flying around. The only thing these guys need to do is connect your cities with railroads. Because you are using the ocean, you do not need to give, a direct quote here, give two shits about pollution, quote unquote. With regards to the Vikings here, and hopefully your alliance with the Americans holds. Mine lasted about 30 years, which was enough to get production and build up my army reasonably. Fighting a two-front war would be much more difficult without a doubt. First things first, the two choke points shown in red and associated screenshots are a pain to fight through, and because they are very underdeveloped, are very slow to fight through. Yeah, the fallout might have something to do with that. This gives the Vikings ample time to nuke or apply stealth bombers to you. Howitzers really should be the main portion of your army. Fighting the triple defense that city walls gives is unacceptable if they've got mechanized infantry behind them, and of course everyone's maxed out the technology tree, so there is no technological advantage. Howitzers, by the way, ignore the effect of city walls in Civilization 2, so there's reason for getting howitzers. The follow-up here is where it gets interesting. I'm thinking, gets interesting? Okay, it gets more interesting as far as I'm concerned. Because all of your production facilities are on islands and transporting them would suck, we are going to, and I'm still quoting from this, abuse the shit out of airlifts. After the landing, I immediately purchase an airport in Sydney and airlift every damn turn into there. That, combined with the constant reinforcements from across the ocean, opens up the soft underbelly of the Vikings. At this point, you can use their own railroad system against them and hit them in the cities towards the back where their bombers and nukes are located. Because, of course, if you take those cities, bye-bye to the bombers and nukes that are located there. As far as fighting America goes, they're very strong with air power, but have minimal ground force. I got the jump on them with a majority of my howitzer army and knocked them from around 430 units on the map to under 250 in a turn. The counterattack for the first turn was very strong, but dropped off rapidly as their bombers lost the airfields they needed to be based out of. Their navy is nothing in comparison with the Viking navy, so if you have any veterans from that, you should sweep aside the weak American navy without issue. You already have a strong railroad connection, so the key here is just hitting them fast and hard. You don't want to get bogged down. So start by taking on the Vikings and then move on to the Americans.
And I am also amused by his city names that are references to Final Fantasy VIII.
This person has also posted a save game of his success. So he's not just saying this. Here's my proof. And also here is a save game from more or less about the start. So you can try to recreate it if you want to. And in fact, he may even makes the argument that if you build offshore platforms, that is a gigantically improved position already. So that's where his initial save comes from. Although we don't have a reaction yet from Brian Reynolds, who designed Civilization 2, which I think is unfortunate, although he just may not have actually been asked. Of course, Sid Meier was asked, and this story and Sid's reaction got into the Associated Press. So Sid Meier told Associated Press, my first thought was, wow, I can't believe anyone has been playing Civ 2 for that long. It's been more than 15 years since we released that game, and I don't think any of us expected a decade-long game would come out of it. It would be amazing if we could come back in 2025 and find out if someone's had a 10-year game of Civ 5 going. And I thought, and of course, that last point, less than a dozen of responses. Oh, Sid.
10-year game of Civ 4, maybe, but no, not Civ 5. I'm not seeing that happening, even with mods.
No, Civ 4 would be impossible. Global warming would happen regardless of if ever a single nuke was fired. Every tile by that date would be desert that's on land. Or tundra.
You mean I'd have a bunch of cities fishing?
Yeah, pretty much. Although corporations could still save you, but you'd get inflation screwed.
Sid Sushi for the win!
You'd probably be in strike.
Oh, well, if I've conquered everybody else.
You could technically keep teching away with only desert tiles and losing that hundreds of gold per turn, and you'd still be able to continue. And it's not like any improvements would be destroyed because you don't have any enemies and all your tiles would be desert, so it would be no longer affected by global warming either. So yeah, I mean, you'd have kind of a static looking empire with specialists and what have you. It would be interesting, certainly.
Civ Fanatics game of the month number 136 is in fact organizing this as a game of the month.
For anyone who's not familiar with Game of the Month in general, I'd definitely check it out. I mean, you have the ability to play the same start that everyone else is playing under a regulated / anti-cheating environment, and you get to compare how games are going with that. Some of the best players have used that as a proving ground in the past, and it's a lot of fun, too. And they do vary the difficulty per whatever each thing in the rotation. Like, they'll go noble to deity, then noble to deity, and, you know, building up one difficulty for each game of the month. At least that's what I've seen. And they give out little awards, E-awards, for those who do certain things, like the fastest culture win, or you get the cow if you have the highest base score because you're milking your score, that kind of thing. It's amusing.
There's also a competition on Reddit, which I think is where Self the Eternal War came from, where there are more than 14,200 registered users at Reddit who have signed up to take this on. And the original article on Reddit, by the way, has more than 3,500 comments. I like the summary that is on the Eternal War. It reminds me of a promo when this becomes a made-for-TV movie. The year is 3,991. The war along the borders of Kiltana, new Viking land in America, has been raging for 1,700 years, and now we find ourselves at a stalemate. The world, ravaged by over 20 nuclear winters, is as good as dead. We can't feed our people, we can't farm our land, we can't afford to do anything but strengthen our military. Supreme Commander Lycerus has led us for as long as anyone can remember, but his time is past, and a new ruler is needed to try to end this goddamn fight. Time to step up.
Always impressive.
This article brought back a lot of memories for those of us who played Civilization 2 when it was released. And in fact, for myself, Civ 2 wasn't the first Civ game that I played, but it wasn't long after I found the original Civilization that Civ 2 came out. I mean, when I played the original Civilization, it had already been out for about 3 or 4 years, and then Civ 2 came out, and I was addicted with Civ, but it was Civ 2 and shortly then getting internet access afterwards that really sucked me into the Civ community. So Civ 2 will always hold a very near and dear place in my heart. Aww. Group hug.
Well, it was a milestone in gaming too, so.
Recorded for episode 140 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Me and Team, Q&L, and Mega Bears Fan.
Civ 4, a lot of multiplayer games are noble there, too. And I disagree that Civ 4 games should be played on Prince, be noble for that matter. A little bit of a translation between games. But either or, because it feels to experienced players anyway, like you're basically not playing paying maintenance at all on noble in Civ 4. So you know, the expansion that you can get away with in say, noble compared to deity in Civ 4 is totally a joke. And I know Civ 5 uses different metrics there, but it still probably matters. And so I don't know if Empire management versus the multiplayer gameplay quality is such that Prince actually works out better in Civ 5 or not. I guess it depends just how badly you're getting gashed on your costs in Civ 5.
And then anything to say with regards to top Civ 4 civs for MP, competitive MP?
My understanding was that as long as you were financially, you were good.
I disagree with that. Financial is very popular, but I think it's almost overrated. Well, it's definitely overrated. I think its quality as a trait is maybe upper middle tier. I don't know why people love it so much.
I hardly
and the same
ever
thing with Rome. I mean, Rome's okay, but you need to hook up iron, and you still lose cost for cost against Axis when you have Praetorians. A lot of multiplayer in Civ 4 comes down to collateral initiative with siege weapons. So if you don't completely rush out Praetorians and hit somebody with them, you're not going to get anything done in Civ 4 because they'll just hit you with catapults. Then your Praetorians will be at like 7 strength or less. Axes will be attacking them at 80% odds or better, and you're dead. And that's not a good experience to have. I would say the top Civ 4 civs are the ones with the good chariot uniques, and then Inca and Mali. Those are the best for their unique units that are very early on. Yeah, Inca's very good, and Malinese are very good. Those civs, especially Mali, has a chance to screw you before you can hook up a resource. That's really terrible. I've seen people quit. Good players quit because they couldn't hook up their copper. The Mali just skirm rushed them and choked them. They couldn't reach their strategic resources. It's so crippling. And Mali also protects against other things better because of the skirmishers too. Like, you can't really attack their cities. They win cost for cost against all non-unique units until knights. They're just so good. And Inca too, just because they not only counter Mali, but they have a nice mix of traits, and the terrace is a really strong building. But certainly war chariots can be big problems. Immortals can be a big problem to defend against, especially if you don't get copper in time. Who are the other good multiplayer civs? I think those that I've just mentioned are perhaps the top tier options. Financial's not bad, expansive's not bad, creative's pretty good to have. So somebody like Surrey is also a top option. A lot depends on your land, too. Financial means a lot more when you have good cottage land versus when you don't.
Or coast.
Yeah, coast is nice, too. You still work a cottage over a coast unless you have Colossus, but Colossus financial strategies can be really nasty.
We have a new patch out as of 6/14. That would be June 14th, as in, what, 2 days ago? I'm so impressive at the mathematics department of things. Anyway, they have made a couple of interesting changes. They finally allowed you to turn off quick combat mid-game in the user interface. There's actually quite a few of the user interface changes, but that's the one that really jumped out at me. And there's also a caution with this patch that some previous saves may not work correctly after updating.
There were some layout changes to Diplo modifiers for better readability and more information. Added a retire button to the game menu. I think my favorite one was this, though, under general. Prevent escape from being used when a leader requests a luxury resource from you. So
so you would get out of the diplomacy screen and the deal wouldn't be made, but it wouldn't count as you refusing it, I bet.
Yes. Yeah. Oh.
Wow. Wow. That one's been there for so long. I didn't even know that was true. That's craziness.
There was also a long-standing courthouse bug that was fixed, and this bug has been around so long and people have gotten so used to it that a lot of people seem to think that the fix was actually an error. What happened was that if you built a courthouse, and of course this is a city that you didn't build yourself, that you have captured and now you've annexed, it would remove unhappiness to the point where you would actually have less unhappiness in a city with a courthouse that you took than a city that you had built yourself.
Wow.
And whereas the courthouse was only meant to remove the occupied unhappiness.
No wonder all the captured cities were so great.
Now, certainly with this patch, there have been a number of complaints, and there have been found very quickly a number of standardized approaches that gets rid of a lot of the problems for most people. One of it has to do with unable to play the game now because units don't move. It's really slow in between turns. The game crashes. It's recommended that you verify your cache because it has been known that you may get a Steam update, but an update to a game through Steam, but you may not get all of the files. go to Steam from the library section, right-click on the game, select properties, and then select the local file tabs, and then click verify integrity of the game cache. There is also, if you have a quote-unquote older computer or have a single-core CPU, then if you do the following, go to your config.ini file, look for the line enable game core threading equals 1, changing it from a 1 to a 0. If you only have a single-core system, then the game is actually trying to use more than one CPU, which you don't have, which no doubt was leading to some slowdowns. And, of course, now the suggestion has been, could that either be disabled by default or at least have it as an in-game option so you don't have to go and manually edit a config.ini file. I think that would be nice, and maybe that will come in another patch.
I did notice it says that our advisors now have era-specific portraits. Does this mean they brought back Elvis as your happiness advisor?
I don't think Elvis is back. Elvis is not
back.
Elvis is not back in the building. I think it's, I heard that it's just that their attire has changed.
Yeah. Oh, no fun.
But at least you know they're not wearing the same clothes for thousands and thousands
of years. Yeah, why are you still wearing a toga in 2012? It's like so, 2 millennium ago, at least.
And then you also hope they'd at least, you know, wash it since the last time you looked at it.
Well, yes, that would be good. Oh, that's where that smells.
What's wrong with wearing
from
a toga?
Well, unless it's a toga party.
It's a fashion statement.
Well, hell. It's certainly a statement, yes.
IGN profiles the Smoky Sky scenario from Civilization V Gods and Kings, and indeed, this is to be the last polycast that we record before Gods and Kings has been released. IGN profiled this scenario, which, as we've discussed in passing before, is a little different. It is not based on anything historical, but rather a what-if. And yes, there are what-if scenarios already for Civilization, but not an official scenario coming from a Civ developer or publisher, and of course, it's coming from Firaxis Games.
What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Gallegos at IGN, here with Justin Davis.
Hello.
And both of us are big Civ players, and this is the new Civ 5 expansion, Civilization 5 Gods and Kings. More specifically, what you're looking at right now is a scenario for Civilization 5 Gods and Kings called Empires of the Smoky Skies, which is a steampunk scenario. So you actually have new cool units like these land ironclads,
yeah,
which are early versions of steam-powered machinery. So it takes place probably in like a early 20th century sort of setting where everyone's kind of coming up with new technologies, and it's almost like as if the world kind of never advanced past that stage in a way.
From the article that Anthony wrote, he says, imagine a world divided into empires obsessed with steam power. These empires ruthlessly undercut and smash their peers into oblivion, not in the name of God, but because such actions are considered valid for the sake of progress. Although it isn't as long as a typical game of Civilization, this is intentional. But IGN says that Firaxis didn't shy away from spending the time developing this scenario, regardless, quote-unquote. To win, players have to earn 3 of 5 titles and hold them for 3 turns. Each of the 5 titles is unlocked after certain technologies have been unlocked, and players constantly knock one another out of position. It results in a constant tug-of-war between civilizations, where one empire can go from 5th place to 1st in a matter of a few turns if they play just right. It's also the most open-ended of our scenarios, said Gods and Kings designer Ed Beach, adding that there's a lot of replayability because of the various victory conditions and how they work on an array of map types instead of a specific landmass. And I think other than the fact that this scenario is not based on something historical, and even if you're not interested in steampunk specifically, the fact that there is this open-ended nature and the apparent replayability lends itself to people like me who view scenarios as it's very linear, I could get into it, but I'd rather kind of play the open-ended, the sandbox version, quote-unquote, the standard version. So when I heard this, I must admit I'm not committing to actually playing the scenario from beginning to end, but I'm not going to dismiss this scenario like I would otherwise.
Yeah, I feel about the same, actually. I mean, I normally don't get into the scenarios too much, but after watching the video and reading about it a bit, it actually sounds like something I'd want to play, just for that open-endedness. It seems like it'll be more like a standard Civ game.
And religion is disabled in this scenario, and espionage does play a part, but particularly if you're coming from Civilization V and then you're thinking about, okay, now there's both religion and espionage, maybe if you're a little intimidated by having to deal with religion and espionage, I mean, yeah, you could do a later game start, I suppose, but perhaps you could actually get into this and then you're realizing I don't have to deal with religion, I'm going to deal with espionage in a different sort of way, in a game that's a bit more micro as opposed to macro, if you follow my meaning. And to end the video, this is what Anthony and the other person had to say. I don't remember the other person's name. I'm sorry, you didn't write the article, so it's Anthony and company.
So I've played Civ, as much as the next guy. I've played a lot of Civ, but I've never really paid too much attention to the scenarios. I don't know, it seems like something that would extend the replay value quite a bit. You know, it seems like it gives them a nice opportunity to, like, custom design a challenge that, you know, the map set up a certain way and the nations are set up a certain way.
You have very specific objectives, you have new types of units that you have to think about how they fight differently in combat. Your goals are just different in this than they are in a standard civilization.
And then what has been called Developer Diary Number 1, which I'm not completely sold on that, only because it really doesn't give us any new information. It doesn't give us a lot of kind of background in terms of the decisions that were made. And indeed, most of the discussion of this video had nothing to do with what either Ed Beach had to say or what Dennis Shirk, Civ 5 producer, had to say, but rather analyzing the screen, what you saw on the screen, frame by frame, to get new information about changes to the technology tree and strengths in units, either new units or changes in existing units, is what really got people going. But let's give both Ed and Dennis their due about what I took from them as to be kind of their core message to the Civilization fans about the Gods and Kings expansion. So we'll hear from Dennis, and then we will hear from Ed.
Really wanted to focus on big gameplay systems that would basically force players to throw their existing strategies over their shoulder and try to figure out the whole thing all over again. So with religion, espionage, the city-state system, the way that combat works, there's just a lot of meat here for any average Civilization fan to really dig into.
Having played Civ 4, I loved the way religion spread across the map and sort of had this historical immersion element drawing you into the game, and it was very interesting to see, you know, where Buddhism spread and which civilizations adopted it and that kind of thing. But I wanted it to have more of an impact on the way the game played out. I wanted those religions to be very, very meaningful in terms of who had which ones and whether you could get the bonuses from one into your cities.
I must say, when Ed was talking about religion and how he said he wanted it to have more of an impact on the gameplay, I'm thinking, did you mean to see like a different impact? Because, oh, religion has impact in Civ 4, all right. I was thinking,
yes, it can be game-changing by itself.
So I wasn't sure about that part of the quote, but otherwise, I was like, okay, I'm following what you're saying. Black Catatonic said, not a lot of new info, but it's nice to see some of the new units in action. Digiel then says, picture-to-picture analysis should grant some new information about unit values. And after a few pages, Fuzzitron717 says, so much info, my mind is blowing up. There's an interesting progression in the tone of the thread. Let's see, what do we know now? At least, and again, this is still subject to change because what you're seeing may not be the completed version. Battering Ram gets 300% attack bonus versus cities. Crystal Redentor does not provide faith. It looks like there is a city combat bonus for ships. The Horse Archer now has 4 movement and a range strength of 10.
Ooh. Sounds like a fun unit.
Refrigeration now unlocks the stadium, new building. Infantry strength is 70. Acoustics no longer unlocks the Kremlin, somewhere else. And the coffee house is unlocked at economics. Pikeman is now strength 16, but its bonus versus mounted is down to 50%, and its flanking bonus is up to 15. And last but not least, swordsman strength is now 14.
Hmm.
Which I think we're all probably immediately thinking about what that would mean if that was in a patch for Civilization V vanilla as it stands. And then, of course, some people started making comparisons to, well, this is going to mean that this unit's going to be better than this, and this unit's going to be better than that. And as was pointed out, combat system overhaul, so making any of those kind of comparisons is next to pointless. Sorry.
It does sound like they buffed the pikemen, though, because previously it had the exact same strength as the sword, whereas now that's not really true. It's stronger. Now, how much that strength means is not necessarily known in Gods and Kings, but certainly they have changed the relative strength of the units, and you can tell just by listening to that just then.
The first promotion for open or rough terrain, based on this video, is down to 15 from 20%. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. You know, when I'm chewing gum, I like the flavor to last longer. I don't know about my combat, though. I guess we'll have to wait and see. And yes, I managed to incorporate a gum analogy onto the show. I give myself an award.
I just have the same fear as always. Like, you're going to get that mass carpet, and if you can't kill the units quickly, you can't get rid of it. That's the only thing I'm worried about. But I'm sure, well, I shouldn't say I'm sure, but I hope that that's been looked at and addressed thoroughly in beta. I hope so. Because anytime you change a model so drastically, you do run into the potential for new issues to crop up. And that's an obvious one, since it was already somewhat of a problem in vanilla on the higher difficulties.
And soon we will have an answer to all of these questions and even more. And Bam Bam says, I can chew gum and Civ at the same time. Impressive, sir. Well, I didn't say I
don't
could.
Chew Civ.
I could try that. Maybe it'll improve my performance.
Chew in my war chariot.
For episode 138 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, QNL, and Izmir Stinger.
Whether or not you should get fail gold at all, whether or not you should get fail anything, and whether or not, in fact, that the fail gold is more even to the point of the OP that it can be even overpowered. It has to be a user's name that I'm going to have to like sound out phonetically here. Sella Biffle says, being a compensation for failing, it should not be the main goal of building the wonder in the first place. Thus, the compensation should at most be what you could have gotten otherwise.
Yes. Another debate I remember being a part of in some fashion or another. I'm not sure if it was this thread or a different thread. A lot of these things are repeat cycles, I tell you. You post in the forum for a few years, and you see the same arguments in different threads. But the problem with that is it's not a lot of the wonders are not sufficiently useful to be worth building. But I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with the fail gold mechanic itself, because if it were truly overpowered, it would be consistently better than your alternatives, and that is not true in Civ 4. Fail gold from chopping into wonders is not consistently better than your alternative. Sometimes you will be chopping into granaries. Sometimes you'll be chopping into units. Sometimes you need gold right this instant, and therefore you'll be building wealth. And sometimes your worker turns. You just don't have that many workers that you want to divert to chopping. You'd rather be improving special tiles first, for example. So it's not such an easy consideration as it's overpowered because you can get fail gold at an impressive conversion rate of hammers to gold. And that, yes, that's useful, but there's a time and a place for it. And because of that, I would argue that the wonders themselves are underpowered rather than fail gold being overpowered. But that's just from like a gameplay logic standpoint. As if wonder is so useless that you would never care to finish it, that's bad.
The fail gold mechanic was a godsend for gameplay. Remember, the alternative in Civ 3 was basically to rage quit. If you spent an even larger proportional amount of your production trying to get the pyramids or something, and you lost it by one turn and were compensated with a screw you, then, I mean, yeah, it was not nearly as enjoyable as, you didn't get the pyramids, but here's 350 gold. See if you can do something interesting with that.
Oh, don't you remember when you could if you weren't successful in getting the wonder, and I forget, maybe it was Civ 2 and early, that you just transferred the committed hammers to a different wonder?
I thought you could do that in Civ 3, although recall that they were shields back then. But yes. Other than that, I thought you could do that in Civ 3 too. Maybe I don't recall correctly. I know you could do it in Civ 2. I think if you switched between types, unit versus standard building versus wonder, you would take a penalty. And with sufficient micro planning, although, geez, I never did any micro planning at all before Civ 4, and even now I'm not known for it. But with micro planning, you could probably get away with failing a wonder and then simply reallocating it into a different wonder as a fallback plan. But that's...
Well, the thing about building the pyramids was the only thing you could transfer the hammers into often would be a spearman, you know, so...
Yeah. That's not so ideal.
And this is a bit of a tangent, but it's still on Civ. In Civilization Revolution, what that would mean is that all that production invested in a particular wonder and you didn't get it, and actually even wasn't defail gold, you could just transfer that to say, okay, build me, say, spearmen, for example, and it would just give you X number of spearmen to however or many hammers you invested. So you could have like 10, 15, 20, boom, instant.
Hmm. Now that sounds like an abusable fail mechanic.
Very.
Yes.
I'm going to build the
pyramid. You declared war on me, huh? Well, guess so what?
My invasion plans involve building the Colossus of Rhodes and the pyramids simultaneously in two to... What?
Oh, so we're not going to be promoting this for Civ 6? No?
And talk about hiding your power and demographics until the last moment. Jeez.
Dan likes his clever and cunning plan.
Recorded for episode 148 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Me and Team, Q&L, and Steve G 700.
We should start with some segues here.
We should.
All right, Dan.
Yeah, it's all you, Dan. Provide us the segue.
Okay. Okay, I know. Here we go. Everyone knows that your most important happiness resource is Polycast, but what about your most important strategic resource? Lisa?
Well, this is a Civilization 4 topic, and it's entitled, What is Your Most Important Strategic Resource? Now, this topic was probably in here because, well, there's a poll in it. Surprise! And it was started by Fear Chugger. How apt. And he says, if you could guarantee that you had one strategic resource close to your capital every game, meaning you are guaranteed to get it, which would it be? He says. Note, I included elephants because they allow the building of war elephants. Surprise, I did not know this. What are war elephants? So basically the 33% of people say iron, which I pretty much agree with. Second most popular is a horse with about 26%. And the next most common is copper with 21%, just about. And then, you know, the other resources are... let's see, in order of importance after that, oil. Come on, who the heck put oil? elephant, marble, stone, and aluminum and coal, then uranium. I must note that one person each put aluminum and coal, and zero people, or no one, put in uranium. God, my English is getting worse. I mean, I'm agreed with the most popular opinion, which is that iron is the most important resource. Copper would be a close second, but, I mean, come on, why would you put oil? I mean, yeah, it's important, but, like, I mean, five people put oil, man! Who are those five people? Okay, I gotta hunt them down and,
now, that's five people for marble, seven people for oil, and I'm... Well, what game lasts so long that you need oil as a guaranteed resource?
And I'm not one of those people who are wrong and voted iron, either. I actually voted horse. And the only two answers, which are possibly even kind of sort of correct, based on the way the opening post is phrased, would be horse and copper. Because he's saying if you could guarantee you had one strategic resource close to your capital. You know, he didn't say that it's the only strategic resource you get, in which case I probably would pick iron just because it's a bit more flexible. You can use it for things like frigates. You can build a much wider range of the medieval stuff. And you can build cannons with that then. But, you know, if you're just picking one resource to have available early, it's definitely horse. It's the fastest rush in the game. It's the best rush in the game. And, you know, you have your cavalry available later as well. And you earlier. Can usually get the other strategic resources if you have horse. And then copper's good, too, just because there, too, you have the bar of defense and the potential to rush somebody if you get into a tight spot. And you can fall back on it for defense as well if need be.
I mean, the way that the semantics of the sentence, the way that it's phrased, I actually end up agreeing with you on that point, because he does say if you could guarantee one. Yeah, and Iron is a little bit less flexible, and you do get it a little bit later. So yeah, continue.
Yeah, but if you get either the plus or the iron capital at the beginning, you're going to end up having some sort of tool to go say hello to your neighbors, if you know what I'm talking about.
Ironwork is too slow for a true rush. It's just, it's way too slow. And, you know, if you actually spawn near some other human who has horse or copper and you only have iron, you're dead. But that's besides the point. An iron-based rush is just really slow. And unless you're Rome, where you get some really strong unit for having iron working, you probably don't want to self-tech it, and you wind up trading for it if trades are on, or getting it a bit later unless you don't have any other strategic resources to defend yourself. And even then, if you're playing the computer, you can often get away with archery then.
Maybe I've been thinking of copper when I said that, because Axeman, you know, the great 8 or 10 axe wonder.
Yes. Chariots do tend to be better than axes, but axes are good too, at least below deity.
Yeah, I voted horse in this poll as well, for reasons that Phil has cited. In addition to that, you've got the speed of the horse, which could, for example, prevent someone, especially if you're close by, to prevent them from hooking up their metal-based resource, which is probably copper. You also have the opportunity, there's also the flanking bonuses and withdrawal chances, and there's also the food aspect as well, because when you get animal husbandry, it's not a guarantee, but if you have cow or, what am I thinking of the other one, pig, there we go.
You're gonna pig or sheep.
Or sheep, there's the other one. So, and I know a lot of people cite one person in particular, Kane3456 talks about, iron for me, you got horses, give me pikes and I'll take my chances. And I interpreted this thread. Before we even get to pikes, let's just backtrack and talk about, you know, spearmen versus mounted units. It's true that in terms of that early rush, yes, if you only have a few mounted units and there's a spearman or two, you're going to have a problem. But if you have sufficient numbers of that and you're able to get yourself onto favorable terrain and also able to withdraw before they can move in, and I suppose this is a bit more talking about the single player as opposed to the multiplayer, just because of the nature of the AI and some of the decisions that we make, which we love to talk about on this show, but not only as we've discussed, but that this is in the ancient era. Like, I think some people were choosing maybe even iron. I could see if you were talking about, actually, I don't even know any start that I would still consider that. But certainly with oil.
Well, come on. What if you're starting in jungle?
Medieval, probably.
Because you could get iron working, get iron quickly, and get, you know, get rid of the jungle quickly as well. And, you know, I mean, for example, if let's say you were starting with a coastal start with a lot of jungle, then, you know, iron working, I mean, you know, that's a prerequisite for compass. And, I mean, that could help you out a lot. And plus, like, I mean, if you didn't have any neighbors, like, anywhere close to you, like, you know, a chariot rush might not be as useful because, yes, chariots can move faster, but, you know, what's the point of capturing a city, like, you know, 20 tiles away from you when you're just starting out?
They're not bad fallbacks as part of defense. Yeah. Boy, none of the strategic resources really matter all that much. If people are that far, attacks in the early game really aren't too realistic. They're so costly versus what you get back in return. That even if you successfully execute one, you're going to be behind where you would be if you just teched up for a while.
So is that an argument against the early rush, or?
Well, Phil is always for the early rush, so.
Okay. Not always.
Depends.
Although,
on the
man,
distance.
You play GameSpy, you start to learn just how common those chariot rushes can get.
Yes, like Mac is getting at, it depends on the distance, and it also depends on who your opponent is, because sometimes your opponent has, especially if they have their unique unit appearing earlier, you may decide that.
I think Phil said in one of our turn casts, he was in a warmonger sandwich with Ragnar and Monty. Yeah, you might want to do an early rush there.
What's the worst that could happen?
Depends on how much you like being their vassal.
I think maybe people who voted oil in this poll, for example, maybe they were a later start individual. And I mean, the people who commented on oil, it doesn't sound like that. But of course, again, I'm certainly assuming that this is an ancient start. And it was rightly pointed out to the person who started this thread, Beer Chugger. That, I mean, I understand the inclusion of elephant. I mean, yes, the game, it is a luxury resource, but it does give you the war elephant. But some people pointed out, why do you have marble and stone in here? And he was like, oh, sorry, I was kind of getting my luxury and my happiness resources a little bit confused. Oops.
Yeah, I was like, what is Marvel in here for?
Oil is the wrong choice for a late era start, though, by the way. If you're going to do a late era start, you'll pick uranium because it's the best strategic resource in the late game by far. Just nothing in the game matches nukes, ever. And once you have nukes, nothing ever really plays stronger than nukes at all. So in the late game, not only that, it's the source of power. You can build Full Metal Navy with uranium. So yeah, you lose out on planes, but you have nukes, and nukes are better than planes, straight up. Now, for a medieval start, as we were talking about that earlier, that's about when I would consider iron over the others. As medieval start, I'm pretty sure you're just at the start of the medieval era, so you don't have knights available yet. And you do have, I believe anyway, you either have crossbows or you can get them in one tech. And you now have access to your full range of units right away using iron. So it's a little bit better there. Maybe even classical, it's not this bad.
There were three comments in the thread that for some humor value, some shock value, some kind of out-of-the-box thinking. RDBH said, I was going to say thumbs, but not in the poll, as your most important strategic resource. Haha. Bra says, past guest on Polycast, any resource that allows me to take the others through conquest? Well, yeah, this is kind of the, if you are guaranteed one, which first off, the fact that I would be guaranteed a strategic resource, of course, yay. But my favorite response was from Pharmatech Bobby, which is, I will Kobayashi Maru the question and answer with Montezuma. And of course, the reason I chose that is not because he mentioned Monty, but because he made a Star Trek reference, and I always approve of those.
It figures.
What units Illuminum actually unlocks, but it does, and so does Cole. I'm like, when I think of Cole, I usually just think of power, which is really useful. Cole Plant is probably the best power resource, but yeah, they also unlock military in it. Yeah, can't forget those kinds of things. Marble and stone don't, though. They're the only things in the list that don't unlock a military in it.
Cole's getting you ironclads.
Yep.
Ironclads. The best.
Wait.
Best unit in the game.
It technically unlocks a unit, so it's technically a strategic resource.
For that mention, Steve, congratulations. You get the troll award.
Oh, wonderful. I'll take it.
We talked about the bankruptcy of Big Huge Games in our last podcast. So there's a couple new news stories, new developments with that story. First of all, there's another news story about a new company called Epic Games. Or it's not actually new. It's Epic Games has existed for a while, but apparently some of the people who lost their jobs from Big Huge Games ended up with new jobs at Epic Games, which is located in Baltimore, along with Firaxis. I wouldn't be surprised if Firaxis benefited it from it itself. Did we discuss last time, by the way, that the owner of Big Huge was a Red Sox pitcher?
Well, no, that was 38 Studios, not Big Huge.
This is
Well, in a way, you're both right in the sense that 38 Studios owned Big Huge Games as a subsidiary.
Right.
Yes, he wasn't the original owner of Big Huge Games.
I see.
That was what, Brian Reynolds, right?
Yes, he was one of the four founders and moved on to Zynga a couple of years ago. And actually, both Turbine and Zynga held job fair near 38's Rhode Island headquarters, in addition to what Epic Games is doing.
Yeah.
We also found out from this that 38 Studios has declared bankruptcy, and the Rhode Island State Police, the FBI, the U.S. Attorney General, and the Attorney General for Rhode Island are working together to investigate the publisher, specifically the conditions around the government loan that brought the company to the area. 38 Studios owes almost $151 million U.S. and has assets of $22 million. And you're thinking... Okay, now it quote-unquote gets better on the financials. Big Huge Games subsidiaries also filed for bankruptcy, owing $121 million and assets of
$335,000. Wow.
Whoa.
Why did Big Huge Games have so much out in loans? Or was that part of the government thing?
Well, it was pretty much, I mean, the Slate story goes over this a lot, but they first went to, you know, regular garden variety VCs, then went to the Massachusetts government, the Boston venture capital firms, who, you know, asked for investment money. They asked for investment money from the venture capital firms, that is. So anyway, they struck out with them, and baseball pun, struck out. And then they moved on to Rhode Island, who fell for it, apparently. Right. The state had like a $50 million fund in order to create jobs in Rhode Island, job creation guarantee program, to provide state-sponsored loans to entrepreneurs. So, yeah, basically Rhode Island ended up going over that budget by $25 million, leading to a total of $75 million, and giving that all to Big Huge Games. So, good job, guys.
And that's so they could develop an MMO.
The whole reason why they did this was for job creation, right? It wasn't just the MMO itself. It's not like, right. You know, there's a bunch of video game fanatics out there in Rhode Island or something. They just thought it would create jobs.
When you look at the cost of development, I mean, those are huge budgets that those guys were working with.
Yeah, somebody in the Rhode Island government was speculating a little bit that, ooh, it's an MMO. Those make a lot of money, right?
And at the same time, they were also banking on the single-player Kingdoms of Amalur, which Big Huge Games had been developing as part of a subsidiary of THQ. And it wasn't all but done, but there was like a little more than a year left out of a 5 or 6 year development cycle when 38 Studios bought them. And then in the hope that the money that they were going to get from Kingdoms of Amalur would help them repay the loan kind of in the short term. And then they would start making money when the MMO, codenamed Copernicus, actually came to fruition, which was supposed to be next June.
Did any of you guys play Kingdoms of Amalur by any chance?
No.
It was okay, but you got to look at like everything else that's come out with like Skyrim. There was The Witcher 2 not too far back.
And then Diablo 3 almost right after it.
Yeah, I mean,
it got really overshadowed.
Yeah, bad timing, definitely. You know, I don't mind so much. Like, I know like the industry, how this all works, how studios fall and, you know, games fail and stuff like that. But Big Huge Games by far is the one I'm most disappointed about. And it's really because I'm just like hanging on to Rise of Nations. Like my love for that game, I don't know. It's just like that nostalgia factor. But technically, when you look at their history since then, like they haven't really made any really good games, except maybe Age of Empires, Asian Dynasties.
Yes, the one expansion for Age of Empires 3 that Big Huge Games did.
Yeah.
Lisa, you had mentioned about the 50 million job creation guarantee program, and then you had mentioned that they increased the size of the fund. A shilling went to the then governor of Rhode Island, Republican, saying that, you know, that shilling said, I want 75 million, but of course the program is only 50, so.
Yeah, they increased their portfolio size to 125 million, making Big Huge Games a 60% of their portfolio. 60%. I mean, that's bad investment right there.
Absolutely. From the Slate.com article that Lisa also made reference to, the author of this, Matthew Lesius, said it was good sense only came to the state this spring when new governor Lincoln Chafee, who'd opposed the deal from the beginning, declined Schilling's plan to have the state to try throw good money after bad in hopes of staving off bankruptcy. And for a state that has 11.2% unemployment, which apparently is second highest in the United States, and if you look at this debt, just the $75 million loan itself, let alone the money that's come afterwards, because I think the bill, the taxpayers, with all the other kerfuffle, is now over $100 million. If it was $75 million, there are 1 million people in Rhode Island. So that's $75 a taxpayer. Wow. So who loses out on this deal? Well, let's see. The employees of Big Huge Games and 38 Studios. The taxpayers of Rhode Island. The gaming community, and who is actually quote-unquote winning out of this? I guess some people might say, well, that Chafee, by what we discussed last about, by saying, oh, you failed to make this first loan payment, so therefore that's the end of you. I think we also criticized Chafee a little bit by saying, you know, the game just came out in February. Maybe if you'd given it a little longer, it actually would have generated some more sales, and then they would have been able to actually pay back something of this, you know, some kind of sense on every dollar that you loan is better than a big fat zero.
Yeah, it's just sad all around. And I was looking at their company profile a bit, but technically they only had that one release, Kingdoms of Amalur, and then there was the MMO. And again, I just want to like point out that the budgets that they had for their games was pretty ridiculous. I mean, I know MMOs are expensive to develop, but I don't understand how the state was able to approve that. I don't even know what the developers themselves were telling the state about how much these games would cost to make. It's an unbelievable amount of money.
Yeah, and a lot of money and up front, too. It's not like, okay, yeah. Over the term, you could get up to $75 million, but at every $2 or $3 million that you ask at certain checkpoints, you need to be able to demonstrate this and this and this, and this is how it's going to be measured. It was just $75 million, here you go, hope to get it back someday.
Yeah.
Yes,
like most publishers, the relationship between developer and publisher is they get milestone payments. And if they don't meet the milestone, they might not get paid, or they might even get the project canceled. Imagine, these guys didn't have to worry about that.
Yeah, imagine a venture capitalist saying no to this. Yeah.
It's going to deter other states from wanting to support the game industry with these types of offers.
Further to that point, other entrepreneurs in Rhode Island, already in Rhode Island, now there's also the question about the Job Creation Guarantee Program. And what about any of the other money that was handed out, or let alone in the future, people trying to make use of that? It's not so much that, of course, the Job Creation Guarantee Program, it's not that it was a bad idea or even a bad implementation. It was just a bad decision on what to use that money for.
Yeah.
So, Rhode Island, big, huge fail.
Sadly, yes.
I think we could sum it up that way, yes.
Yes. And rest in peace, Big Huge Games.
I play the funeral march here, but A, that would be depressing. B, prepare some effort to find it. And C, I mean, yes, it's the death of the company, but as far as the talent that was involved, I mean, we talk about Big Huge Games, it's a company, but I mean, any company, entity, organization, family, it's all about the people. And fortunately, the people are, thanks to other companies in the industry, any other effort just helping spread the word that these people are out of work, and is there any opportunity for that? And Epic has made it clear that we're not going to hire every single person.
Right.
But then, I mean, they're a business too, and they have to be careful when they're looking to expand that they don't overextend themselves, but that there are opportunities, and there was a relatively quick reaction to help people out, immediate and intermediate futures at the very least.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
I think we're going to be getting to the closing here. Thanks to Bam Bam Imperator and T. Jord for joining us in the live stream.
What was that?
No, they're broadcasting live.
Not live. How we stop the insanity.
Do not want.
That time was awesome.
Anyway, this has been Polycast episode 149. I'm still Makalua, and of course with me as always, Dan Q.
Growing old is mandatory. Growing up is optional.
It's true. It's very true. The main team.
I'm sure all of you want to see what my world would look like when it's almost 4000 AD.
It will be very glowy, I know that much. Q and L.
Were you falling off the edge of a cliff or something?
Yes.
And our guest this week, Omerker.
Insert quote here. I'm not prepared.
That works.
Okay, Omerker would be the name to use. Not Omerker.
Yeah, that's fine. You could say Omerker, that's fine. I mean, that's what a lot of people know me by anyway.
All right, on to Forum Talk.
Maggie. Oh, sorry.
Why?
Sorry, Maggie, I was reading the chat. What did you say?
Finally, guest co-host.
He's reading again.
No, sorry. well, actually, yes. But aha! Not the chat this time. Maggie?
What? Where? I didn't want to interrupt anybody. Sheesh. People were talking. And I'm waiting for Dan to say something funny or something.
waiting all for that show though.
For Dan to say something funny. Why? Harsh, Mackie. Very harsh.
I'm unintentionally funny.
Record date June 16th, 2012. IGN Clips Copyright News Corporation. Civilization 2 Clips Copyright Microprose. Civilization 4 and 5 Sound Clips Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.